So good morning. I'm actually more anxious now, having understood that there'd be no heat and light in the building, and that my message would get a chilly reception for reasons that were beyond my control. Now it's back on me somehow. So, kill the fatted calf. I agonized over this title, which makes no sense because, unlike other forms of theological discourse, the title of a sermon is not supposed to bear freight or bear fruit, for that matter. It's intended to be ornamental and decorative, at most anticipatory, like those tiny paper umbrellas that garnish a piña colada. Sorry, Carl, a virgin piña colada. There are so many things potentially wrong with this title, though. First of all, it's a command, a full-blown imperative. We shy away from commands here at Assembly. They're so non-egalitarian, militaristic even. Imperatives imply a power differential that we will not own. We prefer the indirect request or the passive-aggressive suggestion. In our community, one shouldn't even notice that they've been ordered to do something until it's way too late. And then there's the killing part. Not really the right word for Assembly either. Perhaps a better title for us would be Eat the Fatted Calf. Metaphorically, it achieves the same purpose and in addition evokes warm memories of potlucks, picnics, and the relief sale. It also tastefully obscures the inconvenient truth that though most of us do eat meat, we don't kill, God forbid. Fatted calf is problematic as well because it's an anachronism. Nobody talks like that anymore. It's a feeder calf. In the translation of the pained modern version, Abraham receives his heavenly visitors unawares in Genesis 18 and tells his servant, unwrap a few veal cutlets from their cellophane packages. Fry them up for our enigmatic guests, please. Now, kids, I'm going to use Wikipedia here. And surely your teachers have warned you of the dangers of such reckless roaming of the internet. You shouldn't try it without adult supervision. But used with discretion and a snobby, critical attitude, it can be a handy source of general information in such hypothetical circumstances as the closing of the library for fall break, et cetera, et cetera. And this is what Wikipedia has to say about the meaning of the fatted calf, along with my own editorial comments intended to red flag problem areas. So, fatted calf is a metaphor. Wikipedia is from this side. My comments are from this side. Fatted calf is a metaphor or symbol of festive celebration and rejoicing for someone's long-awaited return. So far, so good. It derives from the parable of the prodigal son in the New Testament. This may be true in the narrow sense in which we tend to use the phrase, but references to fatted calf far predate the New Testament. In biblical times, spanning thousands of years across differing cultures, the imprecision here is shocking and may actually make you physically sick. People would often keep at least one piece of livestock. One would have preferred head of livestock, piece of livestock, that was fed a special diet to fatten it up, thus making it more flavorsome. Flavorsome is a typical Wikipedia word. We might say savory. More savory when prepared as a meal. Slaughtering this livestock was to be done on rare and special occasions. Thus, when the prodigal son returns, the father kills the fatted calf to show that the celebration is out of the ordinary. Well, Actually, I think it's more about the magnanimity of the parent in the face of the older son's ingratitude. In modern usage, killing the fatted calf can simply mean to celebrate in an exuberant manner, as used in the Elton John song, Benny and the Jets. For those of you under 50 years of age, that's a Wikipedian metaphor. The relevant text reads, and I will intentionally recite the lyric in the mode that scripture is often recited in churches throughout the land, assembly accepted, of course. Hey, kids, shake it loose together. The spotlight's hitting something. That's been known to change the weather. We'll kill the fatted calf tonight. So stick around. You're going to hear electric music. Solid walls of sound. Well, in addition to these difficulties with the title, it's also my intention to seriously distort the traditional meaning of the metaphor to serve another purpose. As is my right, under Section 42, Paragraph 7 of the Assembly Handbook, and I quote, "Absolutely anyone can preach at assembly and say whatever the heck they want. Only the preaching of the pastors and the teaching elders will be carefully delimited." Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to admit that I just made that up. But it sounds like it could be true. That's the point. As laid out in Tom's introduction to the theme of the fall Bible study, we have set for ourselves as a congregation the 3-year goal of radical hospitality. Now, I must admit, I was severely tempted to use this opportunity to deconstruct the whole notion of radical hospitality, as is my right under Section 42, Paragraph 7. I mean, it's so assembly to strive for radical hospitality. No run-of-the-mill, normal hospitality for us. No, ma'am. We're after extreme hospitality. In-your-face hospitality. Revolutionary hospitality. Hospitality till it hurts. If we could, we would direct our charitable energies to the Goshen Interfaith Radical Hospitality Network. But since all of this could not have distracted us from the more important work at hand, that section of the sermon did not make the editorial cut. Do I hear a thank God? Yes. What you came to hear this morning is a sort of general introduction to the biblical and ancient Near Eastern practice of hospitality. And rightly so. How are we supposed to proceed with a fall Bible study on this theme without knowing how some people long ago and far away treated strangers and guests in an entirely different culture and context? The title of this sermon should have been Introduction to Hospitality. Schluss. Chalas. Period. Perhaps too much damage has already been done. At the very least, we'll call that the subtitle. I'll return to this theme of radical hospitality a bit later, but for now it may be enough to make the case for the virtue of good old-fashioned regular hospitality. It's probably safe to assume that most of us here have some sense for what hospitality is, or at least what it isn't. In other words, what constitutes the failure of hospitality. We can even bring it very close to home. Many of us are here because at a time when we were strangers and guests, we were welcomed and received at an assembly worship service or in a small group. But no matter how many greeters at the doors, no matter how much coffee we swill, no matter how much small talk we engage in, there are those who have come to assembly and not felt welcomed, who have not received the minimum requirement of personal acknowledgement and engagement. Of course, we cannot be all things to all people. But part of the challenge of this moral virtue is that hospitality must both conform to shared universal norms so that it will be recognized as such, and yet adapted to welcome the stranger in all of their strangeness and uniqueness and mystery, and move towards the kind of engagement that will serve and support them. Perhaps the question for us is there a pattern to our failure in those cases where hospitality is not extended. When we think of the term hospitality or the actions that reflect the proper attitude, what comes to mind? What words and actions do we associate with hospitality? And I ask this not rhetorically, but interactively. What do you associate with hospitality? Just call out some words. Food and drink. Food. Sorry? Conversation. Companionship. Knowing names. Welcome. Invitation. Safety. Good. Well, interestingly enough, the terms hospitality and hostility are derived from the same Latin root. Hostis. Enemy, stranger. Combining hostis with potis gives us hospes, a term that may refer to both guest and host. One known cognate in Indo-European languages is the Slavic or Russian gospodi, lord or master. The Greek word for hospitality used in the New Testament, philoxenia, combines the terms for love, philos, with the word for stranger or foreigner, xenos. Philoxenia. It is the literal antithesis of xenophobia. Likewise, Arabic derives the terms for guest and host from the same root. The daif is a stranger, a visitor, a guest. The mudif is the one who creates the proper conditions to receive the daif, to care for the daif, to shelter and protect the daif. One might even say to transform the stranger into daif. In her 1999 study entitled A Christian View of Hospitality, Expecting Surprises, Michelle Hershberger of Heston College explores this concept of welcome of the stranger and its application as a spiritual discipline in the life of the church. She recounts examples of the ancient virtue of hospitality from many cultures and regions of the world. She writes, in nomadic life, where there were few public places to obtain lodging and food, the practice of hospitality was necessary for survival. The wandering traveler was at the mercy of their host. On the other hand, the host had little chance to hear about the larger world except through the tales of the guest. Thus, the two parties, usually strangers to each other, formed a kind of partnership. The Bible contains many stories that reflect this virtue of hospitality, even when it is not necessarily the focus of the story. When Job makes an impassioned defense of his innocence in chapter 31, one of the virtues that he said he never neglected was hospitality. In 31:32, he exclaims, "The sojourner has not lodged in the street. I have opened my doors to the wayfarer." In his first speech, his friend Eliphaz of Teman seems to confirm this. He says, "See, you have instructed many. You have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have supported those who were stumbling, and you have made firm the feeble knees." Romans 12:13 says, "Contribute to the needs of the saints. Practice hospitality." Literally, it says, "Pursue hospitality." And the verb implies a continuous action. So this command in Romans 12:13 is that hospitality not be just a once-a-year thing, but a constant attitude and practice. Our homes and apartments should stand constantly ready for strategic hospitality, a readiness to welcome people who don't ordinarily live there. All actions performed daily and all actions carried out during the course of life can be raised to the status of worship simply by doing them. And this is the principle also taught by the Prophet Muhammad. In one of the hadiths, he's quoted as saying, "Let the believer in God in the day of judgment honor his guest." Honoring or treating a guest well is coupled with two of the most important beliefs in Islam, belief in God and in the day of judgment. In Islam, the hospitality relationship is triangular. It consists of host, guest, and God. Hospitality is a right rather than a gift, and the duty to supply it is a duty towards God. We might also make a parallel with and a baptism, where simple tasks like offering a cup of cold water, a meal, or a place of shelter may be raised to the status of worship when done in the name of Christ. The prophet Amos implies as much when he juxtaposes acts of justice and righteousness, which I think is a phrase that corresponds roughly to our peace and justice, with the ritual acts normally associated with worship, religious festivals, church gatherings, sacrifice and prayer, songs and music. He's not challenging the appropriateness of these forms of worship per se, but making the point that worship must be accompanied by acts of mercy and justice, and ethics must be grounded in worship. Mennonite relief efforts in Europe after World War II were often accompanied by the MCC logo in the name of Christ. So significant were these supplies in some areas that it led to the apocryphal story of the delegation which some years after the war was sent to the United States to express their gratitude. Disembarking in New York City, they were overwhelmed by the scale and grandeur of the place, leading one delegate to remark, "If this is New York, just think what Akron must be like." Apocryphal, I'm sure. The God-centered motivation for hospitality begins in the Old Testament. Perhaps the clearest text is Leviticus 19. When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do that person wrong. The stranger who sojourns with you shall be to you as the native among you. You shall love that person as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. The importance of hospitality was reinforced in many places with the notion that the gods visit culture heroes incognito, thereby testing their virtue. One remembers in this regard the classical Greek saga about the visit of the three gods, Zeus, Poseidon, and Hermes, to the childless Hyrieus in Boeotia. After they have been received and served by him, they help him acquire the son he has longed for. Doubtless you're familiar with the admonition in Hebrews 13:2 that reflects the same assumption. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by so doing, some have entertained angels without knowing it. In these and other ancient stories, we see not only that hospitality is the moral order of ancient times, and in a sense, the first real virtue, but that every encounter with the stranger constitutes a moral test. Indeed, it has often been suggested that one of the three visitors to Abraham and Sarah must have been Yahweh, a veiled appearance of the aniconic and enigmatic God of Israel. So we turn our attention now to that ancient story in Genesis 18, in which this ancient virtue of hospitality is embedded in the patriarchal and matriarchal narrative of the Bible's culture heroes. It's not just the faith of Abraham and Sarah, reckoned as righteousness, that proves them worthy to receive the laughable announcement of the belated end of their barrenness. But their moral virtue is first established by the welcoming of the three strangers as guests. The entire incident is designated an appearance of Yahweh to Abraham. In theology, we call this a theophany, the manifestation of a deity to humans, often in disguise. Abraham is sitting at the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. He looks up and sees three men standing near him. Now, we may think of these visitors as three men, as the NRSV and virtually all other modern translations read, although the grammatical rules of Hebrew allow for the possibility that the group consisted of mixed gender, two men and a woman, or two women and one man. The writer does not specify, and therefore it's left up to our imagination. How might that change the story? Abraham runs from the entrance of his tent to meet them and begs them not to pass by before he has the opportunity to extend hospitality, to be mudif. It reminds me of an Amish friend, a kind of host par excellence who welcomed me to stay with him and his family for a couple of extended stays when I was in college. He was intensely curious about the world and used to invite all foreigners who found themselves in the vicinity of Howe, Indiana, which is, you know, a rather select group, granted, but he would invite them to come to his home without exception. It also suggests that hospitality is not just a matter of receiving those who come seeking assistance. By offering hospitality before any need is addressed, the host guards the dignity of the stranger. All are welcome, regardless of status and story, of journey or jeopardy. Abraham has to leave the secure confines of the entrance of his tent in order to make contact with the strangers. He goes to them before they come to him. He implores the strangers with a request for the privilege of serving them, and they give permission. Radical hospitality does not mean forcing aid on the needy, but respecting the dignity of the stranger by asking for and receiving permission to extend grace. There are no assumptions about the circumstances, just the recognition that persons unknown have come into one's vicinity, travelers of undetermined origin. Hospitality does not impose victimhood upon the stranger, but receives all foreigners as one would receive a familiar guest. When Abraham meets them, he bows to the ground, a sign of respect used in a variety of social contexts, in worship, in deference to royalty, before social superiors, etc. And when he addresses them, he uses the traditional form of honor and respect. If your servant has found favor in your eyes. So what constitutes the tangible elements of hospitality in this case? Well, he first offers water for the washing of the feet of the weary travelers. He offers rest in a shady spot. He provides food. Sometimes it's translated bread, sometimes cakes. The Hebrew word ugah today means cake, as we would know it. But in this case, I suspect something more like baked goods above the level of flatbread. So whatever we call that. He calls for 3 measures of choice flour as if 1 seah for each traveler. The approximate mass of a seah, as well as we can reconstruct, it's a dry measure of capacity equal to about 7 quarts. 1 seah, 7 quarts. So 3 seahs of fine flour, amounting to almost 23 liters, is a considerable amount, perhaps purposely exaggerated by the storyteller. That's going to make a lot of cake. Abraham also runs to the herd and selects a calf described as tender and good, which he gives to the servant to prepare. And these items he serves to the guests along with curds and milk, which represent liquid refreshment in a hot, dry climate. This evokes for me the story of the ancient story of Sunui, the Egyptian court official, it's one of the oldest stories in human literature. It's at least 4,000 years old. And it's the story of this official who, upon the assassination or the death of the king, is forced to flee his land, flee Egypt, and he flees to Syria, Palestine in the day, 2000 BC. I mean, as far removed from the life of Jesus before as our lives are removed from Jesus after. So when he gets there, he is received by these Asiatics. They're called Asiatics by the Egyptians. And they're considered really kind of rough-hewn types, you know, frontiersmen. They wear skin coats. I mean, nothing compared with the civilization of the Egyptians. And the text says I set out at night, and at dawn I reached Petén up in Syria, Palestine. I halted at the Isle of Kemwer. An attack of thirst overtook me. I was parched. My throat was burned. I said, "This is the taste of death." And I raised my heart and collected myself and heard the lowing sound of cattle and saw Asiatics. One of their leaders who had been in Egypt recognized me. He gave me water and boiled milk. I went with him to his tribe. What they did for me was good. One of the oldest stories that we have preserved, hospitality, is right at the center of his experience. Abraham presents them with food and drink under the tree in the shade where they are resting and stands by them as they eat. So he doesn't necessarily join them in the meal. It's not a banquet in which he will also participate. There's no obvious, tangible, immediate payback for Abraham and Sarah for this act of hospitality. The guests eat the fatted calf, and it is no longer available for the sustenance or enjoyment of the hosts. This reminds me of the warning of our beloved Bishop John Steiner back in the days when the relief sale was just starting. And he warned us, I mean, it was totally against the stream as it would be to this day, even more so today, perhaps. He warned us that the type of charity that depends on payback, that depends on an immediate reward, presents a departure from the virtue of altruistic service and sacrifice. After this act of hospitality, the visitors reveal themselves as messengers, perhaps divine messengers, and deliver the first annunciation in the Bible, the news that Sarah would bear a child. There's a Quranic version of this story, typically brief, to the point. "Has the story reached you of the honored guests of Abraham? Behold, they entered his presence and said, 'Peace.' And he said, 'Peace.' And he thought, 'These seem unusual people.' Then he turned quickly to his household, brought out a roasted fattened calf and placed it before them. He said, 'Will you not eat?'" The Bible also contains examples of catastrophic failure of the norms of hospitality. Many interpreters have associated the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah with some kind of deviant sexuality, but it really reflects first and foremost a radical failure of hospitality, of receiving the stranger. In the last four chapters of the book of Judges, in a series of events Phyllis Trible has aptly called texts of terror, the mistreatment and murder of the Levite's concubine by the townsmen of Gibeah of Benjamin provides a shocking prelude to the demise of pre-kingship theocratic Israel and descent into chaos and fratricide. To fail the test of hospitality is to sin against God in biblical terms. So how are we at Assembly? How do we turn strangers into guests? Hospes into hospes. Hostis into hospes. The enemy into doyef. How do we become doyefin? How might we live lives saturated with acts of kindness towards strangers, foreigners, and even enemies? How do we foster a culture of knee-jerk hospitality that is as natural as bringing our offerings to the front? As common as coffee and conversation, how do we teach our children that care of the stranger is not a matter of good manners and etiquette, but a sacred duty that everyone is expected to observe? And ultimately, what kinds of attitudes and actions would move us towards a radical hospitality that exceeds the norm, that pushes the boundaries of convention, and perhaps even takes us out of our comfort zone? What forms of killing the fatted calf are we being called upon to exercise? What intrusions into our busy lives and strained pocketbooks? In Luke 15, the misnamed parable of the prodigal son, it's implied that obligations to the stranger should extend to all, both the stranger and the estranged. Radical hospitality is creative hospitality. Proactive, not reactive. pushing at the boundaries of conventional virtue and customary practice. It may even involve, as suggested in the book, The Gift of the Stranger, Faith, Hospitality, and Foreign Language Learning. I know, predictable, but a great book. It may imply that there is a spiritual and moral dimension in that ordeal of learning someone else's language and culture. Certainly these and other themes will be explored in the weeks to come as Carl and Nathaniel and Sarah and Kay share their wisdom about the meaning and exercise of hospitality in worship, in community engagement, and in the countercultural politics of the kingdom of God. One caveat for us to ponder as we prepare ourselves to enter into this study. If we want to continue to talk the radical talk, then we have to be prepared to walk the radical walk, wherever that might lead. Are we ready to kill the fatted calf and care for the stranger, no matter what the cost? May God use this study series to help us discern and act in ways that prove us worthy heirs of Abraham and Sarah. Amen.